You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
You are here for a panel talk called Pulling the Levers, which is going to be all about how we can address climate change and what are the levers for doing that. I'm going to introduce our panel first. So it's going to be hosted by Rich Elliott, who is part of the Pitquell Foundation. We have Simon Sharp, who was in here earlier as well. We have John Long, and we have Gail Bradbrook. Can we give them a round of applause before they begin?
Hi there. Can everyone hear okay? Does that sound good at the back? Great. We might be competing with main stage. We'll see. We were just pleased that it was acoustic so far. So we'll see what style of music is on next. So welcome to this panel session on theories of change, particularly looking at the key levers that we have for addressing the climate and nature crisis. As a format, we're going to have a sort of discussion for probably around 35, 40 minutes and then leave plenty of time for questions that you can either nominate someone in particular for a question for or to the whole panel. So in a second, I'm going to get our esteemed panel members to introduce themselves. But just a very brief introduction to myself first. So I'm going to be chairing the session. And I'm from the Pitquell Foundation, one of the co-founders of the Pitquell Foundation. And it's been a real privilege for us at the Pitquell Foundation to sponsor this hothouse venue at Greenbelt for this is for the fourth year now. We were really keen to enable or to help Greenbelt to facilitate them having a focused climate change and environmental kind of space. And each year we have great fun as a team kind of creating and vibing and installing and creating a themed space. As an organisation, we're part of the Environmental Funders Network, which is a group of trusts and foundations that support, it's basically philanthropic grant giving to organisations that are working within the environmental kind of space. And as the topic of this session is on theories of change and points of leverage, that the things that we are trying to leverage, I suppose, in terms of the grant giving that we do, is organisations that are working in the areas of policy, that are working on legal solutions and looking at financial levers. And that's both inside and outside of government. And our other work is to support sanctuary seekers. So to support people who are seeking asylum or are seeking refuge as a place of safety in the UK. And you'll see from the theme of this year that we're particularly interested in where climate change is interfacing, intrinsically linked to and affecting, not always in a straightforward way, human movement. So that's a bit about that. And we had a bit of a pre-discussion beforehand, and one of the things that we might talk about or might not talk about is the role of philanthropy and problematizing that a bit in terms of theories of change. So I'm going to pass over to Simon and then along just to briefly introduce ourselves before we go to our first question.
Hi everybody, I'm Simon Sharp. I spent most of my career in government, nearly 20 years, and half of that working on climate change. And I left government a couple of years ago so that I could still work on climate change, but work with other countries' governments, not just ours. And this morning I was here talking a lot about diplomacy, but my main focus at the moment is the economics of the transition and how that's understood, which maybe we'll say something about as we get on to it.
Well, thank you. Hello, everyone. My name's John Long, or J-Lo, if you prefer. And I am I'm doing a show at 8 o'clock here, if you'd like to come along. And I'm a comedian, and I work in stand-up comedy and cabaret, but I have a background in environmental education. That's my area of interest, was from the waste industry very, very specifically, but mainly about education, how you get across these quite big concepts to everyone and how everyone is different. And so this, I'm going to be doing a lot more listening, I think, than talking on this debate, because we've got very really educated people on the subject, but it's a subject I'm fascinated by. But come see me at 8 for my position in the form of jokes. Thank you. Is that one work?
I think this one's working, so we could share this one. My name's Gail Bradbrook. I'm a co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. Before Extinction Rebellion, I was involved in the anti-fracking movement. We were also trying to see off an incinerator in Stroud. I got my boobs out for that in Gloucestershire, not a pretty sight, but, you know, needs must. Breastfeeding was the connection. Because of the dioxins. Anyway, just try anything, don't you? Mostly didn't work. So whatever theories of change I've been running with. I'm a mother of two boys, and I think I'm basically an autistic nerd, totally curious about the question of why are we here and what can we do about it?
Okay, we're going to start with a really nice, easy question. Just to hear from each of the panel, just a big question. What do you see as the most important levers when addressing the climate and ecological crisis? So for you, what are the most important levers?
Can we just start?
Okay, yeah, it is quite a big question, isn't it? Government policy is indispensable. It's enormously powerful. When the right things are done, then change is fast. If we're talking about climate change, then in the UK, on the whole, we're doing quite badly. Most areas, we're not doing very well. There's one area we're doing outstandingly well, decarbonising the power sector, electricity generation. In this country, we've done it 8 times faster than the global average over the past decade. And that is the result of having the right policies, some by judgment, some by luck. But when you get it right, the pace of change is extremely fast. Now, the right government policy is an outcome of many things. It's an outcome of campaigning, activism, political leadership, all kinds of different things. But I'll mention one thing that I'm particularly focused on, economics. Reason for that. When governments make policy, they care very much about what are the outcomes in terms of what we call the economy. What will it mean for costs of things that people buy? What will it mean for jobs? What will it mean for how successful this country thinks it's doing? How it affects people's living standards? That's incredibly important as an influence in public policy making. And so it matters, how does government understand the economy? And at the moment, our dominant understanding of the economy is based on some really old ideas, some stuff that people came up with 150 years ago, where they thought they wanted economics to be like a science, and so they had to express it in terms of equations. So they borrowed stuff from Newtonian mechanical physics and said the economy must be in equilibrium. It's a thing that's stuck, it's fixed, it never changes, that's how it is. That made it possible to solve equations and make it look like a science. Unbelievably, we're still stuck with that now. That paradigm is still what's informing how governments think about the economy. And when the problem you're trying to solve needs really fast structural change in the economy, if you think about it as being stuck in one place and never changing, that's quite a big problem. And it leads you to all of the wrong kind of answers. And I can elaborate on that if we come to it in debate, but I'll just say that for now as a starting point.
Hello, can I just say that was a lovely backing to your point. And as you got more passionate and sat forward, the music seemed to swell. It was quite moving, actually, just to witness.
I don't normally have that.
I think you should incorporate him into your lecture. I'm a bit obsessed with what creates change, but I don't have much of a science background on it, so I don't. But it seems to be, from all the things I've explored, it comes down to, with me a lot of the time, why I do things is because, well, that's just how I do things. I don't put too much conscious thought into it. It's just what people around me seem to do, and I go along with that, by and large. There's some things I set aside, they're very passionate about them, but most things. And I'm obsessed, like you said, it's when something's the norm. What I think is that human beings sometimes are quite reluctant when it comes to change, but we're actually very adaptable. As we saw during the lockdown, when a change is thrust upon us, we will adapt. We will find a way. And so I think trying to do it by convincing everyone to change their ways is a very slow and cumbersome way to go about it. And I think obviously top-down change is the way forward. And then people will adapt. So it's a lot of what you were talking about with policy. That seems to be, how do we get that there quicker? Citizens' Assembly seems to be something that I'm particularly passionate about, but there's lots of different ways to do it, through protest, through charities that sue governments that don't hold up their end of the bargain. Lots of different ways, but they all come from the top. And I'm sort of sick of the pressure being put on the individual, being put in an environment where they're set up to fail and then being made to feel like they are part of the problem, which we all are, but not directly. And it's that's my sort of angle, personally. I'm going to pass on to more articulate people now. Thank you.
I'm going to be deeply inarticulate now. Thank you. I think the first thing to start with is understanding the nature of the problem. I don't think climate change is the problem. I think it's a symptom. And so what is it as a symptom of? I think it's a symptom of an extractive economic system, and that's a symptom of trauma and systematized trauma. And fundamentally, that's a spiritual malaise. I also think that we set off on this path about 5,000 years ago, a sort of paradigm of domination, and it's got a systemic mechanism in it called the success to success mechanism. So if you get some power, you get more power, that, you know, money gets more money, etc. And so we have to find a way to disempower a system that's been running for a long time, including in our own bodies. How do you go about that? One of the things is to understand that money really relates to natural resources, and a lot of the natural resources are in the global south. So a talk I did just a couple of hours ago was talking about the power that's in the global south, and I was talking about the alliance of Sahel states and Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, who are now refusing to pay debts and refusing to have their mineral resources extracted and robbed from them by colonial powers in the global north. So how we relate to the rest of our family matters, and who we pay attention to matters. I think it's interesting to think about... I was going to start commenting on other people's things, but I think I'll wind my neck in for a minute. I think I'll leave it at that. I think there's something about the power in the global south, and beyond that... The theory of change that I guess I'm trying to work with at the minute is what it means to come back into life and to be an ecosystem of change that is life-affirming. And that's a really big question, but I won't try and articulate more about that now. Was that articulate? I don't think it was.
A lot of nodding. Yes, it was.
Okay, thank you. So I think we're all agreed that whatever measure we use, we're not moving fast enough, we're not moving at the scale or the pace that we need to. Just a quick plug, Simon has written an exceptionally good book, which I think is probably the best climate book that I've read in the last few years, called Five Times Faster, which is about the fact that actually we need to be moving in terms of cutting our emissions at a rate five times faster than we have up to 2030 than we have over the last 10 years. But I think, as Simon was saying this morning, even now, since he wrote the book, we're probably, you know, the second edition should be coming out soon and might well be called 10 times faster, because we're lagging already behind that. And I wonder whether you can take it in any order you want, but you can comment on actually what are the things that are working that we need to be focusing on, but also what are the red herrings, by which I mean what are the things that are taking our time, money, attention, resources, which actually aren't going to have an impact or aren't having an impact, and what then do we need to be doing differently?
Well, if you look across the whole landscape of progress on climate change and you had to pick out one thing that is going well, then you would probably pick solar power. And, you know, it's almost worth looking back before you look forwards. Go back 10 years ago and there was not very much solar power deployed globally. And if you look at The Economist magazine, which I used to read back in those days before I realized it was kind of wrong on a lot of things, they were saying subsidizing solar power is a terrible idea. Government should not be doing that. It's very, very wasteful. It's the most expensive way to cut emissions. And the International Energy Agency kind of agreed with them. And they said, look, the cheapest thing to do to reduce a bit of emissions is make your coal-fired power stations more efficient. You know, you can do that. It's really cheap in terms of dollars per ton. Look at what's happening now. The amount of solar deployed in 2020 was more than 10 times as much as governments had expected 15 years earlier. The International Energy Agency now describes it as the cheapest electricity in history. And if you look at the private sector's plans to build solar panel manufacturing factories, and you look at the capacity that represents by 2030, it is more than what we need, consistent with a pathway of limiting climate change to 1.5 degrees. Now, actually, we may fail to limit it. That the sensitivity of the climate is a different issue. But in terms of the pace that everybody set themselves, solar is beating that, is going faster. Now, what has made that happen? Fundamentally, subsidies. Subsidies and regulations. Subsidize the clean technology, get it into the market, prompt that reinforcing feedback, the positive feedback loop of investment, innovation, cost reduction, rising demand, more investment, and that accelerates itself. And that's why we've seen spectacular progress there. That's basically what we need to do in each of the emitting sectors of the economy. And I completely agree with Gail that that will leave a lot of problems unsolved. There are deeper problems that won't be addressed within the next 6 years or so and won't be addressed with that kind of approach. But we have to halve global emissions in this decade. That means halve global emissions in the next 5 years or so. And to get that done, we've got to seriously start investing in the solutions the way we've done in solar across every emitting sector. And sorry, you asked about distractions, but I'll come back to that if you want. Sorry.
Yeah, come back.
Do you want a serious point? I want you to go first. No. I'm going to be very quick. I'm always so narrow. My whole experience is in the waste industry, so I'm going to answer entirely through that. But it does happen a lot, distractions. And the whole idea, again, like I was talking about personal responsibility, seems the way you can do it. So the idea that, you know, a carbon footprint and looking inwardly. And we now know, obviously, that comes from organisations like BP and PR organisations coming up with that phrase to distract us from the bigger issues. And the way it happened in the waste industry was recycling, which if you look at the waste hierarchy, when I was talking to children, the three R's, which in my day was writing, reading, arithmetic. But now, reduce, reuse, recycle, in its very basic form, recycle is the bottom for a reason. And it's very limited in what it can do. But it was used a lot as a way to make people feel like they were tangibly doing something, because we wanted to do something, rather than talking about the big issues around waste, like standardization, and where does the burden, responsibility of waste, shouldn't that be on the supermarkets a bit more so that they deal with it? You know, all these questions were being ignored because we were just talking about, are you recycling enough? And the people would come to the tip and say, why aren't we recycling foil? But not talking about the slightly bigger issues. So there's a lot of ways you can distract people. And a lot of the times it's about talking about what aren't you doing? Yep. So that's my very quick answer.
Thank you. Yeah, I had the great pleasure in 2019 of being part of Extinction Rebellion when I think it was really in its honeymoon period. And we did make a big difference in terms of breaking through climate denial in a short space of time. And I think one of the things that we did well was to create a spirit for a movement. And the spirit for a movement has vision and wisdom and agency and togetherness in it. It's not just a simple thing of like demands, and it has principles and values. It has, I can't call it anything else. It's a spirit. And I think we have got to remember that that aspect is really necessary alongside really, really good organizing, detailed and meticulous organizing. And part of what I was involved in, but I really feel like we need more focus on, is to focus on the economic system and its inherent problems. And its inherent, the destruction is baked into capitalism. And one could talk about how we define capitalism, but I don't actually think we've got a very functional capitalism, even by its own description. And so to sort of call out the economic system, how do you go about that? You have to sort of attack some of the actors in it, and we need to have some really, really cool defined actions focused on the economic system. The best I could come up with was taking a hammer to Barclays Bank, but there might be better, more funky things to do with that. I also think water bill strikes at the minute, take back water is good to focus on as well. That's winnable. But fundamentally, and I agree that it's a distraction, the individual change. For me, that's a matter of integrity. Where do I feel integrity? But what we're trying to do is find a way to be together as things fall to pieces. And when I say that what we're really trying to do is create life-affirming systems, we have to look how a life system operates. And life systems do some funky things. One is they have a purpose, and the purpose is not decarbonising the economy or, you know, this policy or that policy. The purpose is beauty and complexity and more life. Life begets more life. So what purpose do we feel together? What can we feel in our bodies as we let life come through it, as we let divinity come through it? And then life learns. It's a learning system. We're not machines. This is the whole point of how scientism has sort of destroyed our thinking, really. Human beings and the rest of nature, they're not mini machines. We are a learning process. We're a process that's undergoing itself constantly. And so to be able to learn is really, really foundational. And the other thing that life does is it collaborates. And why I'm mentioning all those collaboration in many, many different ways. We know about the mother tree in the forest. We know about how one animal that we mind, you know, listen to David Attenborough. And I know we all love David Attenborough, me too. But actually, the way those nature programs are put together, they make nature, this bit of nature's battling that bit of nature. It's not, it's a complete act of reciprocity on an ongoing basis. It's an orgiastic eating of one thing by another thing. It's not, we don't have to see it as this sort of like a Darwinist and actually Darwin didn't say that as it happens, but you know, this sort of Darwinist battleground. Collaboration's really important. The anti-life paradigm, the domination paradigm that lives in us, makes us not really learn, but just keep doing the same thing over and over again and not really collaborate. And I am really trying to hospice that part of myself that's quite snidey and doesn't want to collaborate and wants to sort of be right, you know, and have the answers and all the rest of it. Like, where you learn by listening, right? And you make action by collaboration. And I think they're the big changes that we need to find within ourselves. Thank you.
Yeah, if I can, yeah. Maybe pick up on a point that both of you are making, actually. John referred to the idea of a carbon footprint being promoted by the oil company, BP. And that's right. I only learned about that in the past year. And when I saw it, actually, I was only surprised for a little moment, and then I wasn't surprised. And I learned from one of the articles written about this that there's good precedent for that kind of thing. That early in the 20th century, there were car companies that were behind campaigns on how to be a safe pedestrian. And at the same time, of course, they were lobbying governments against having speed limits or requiring seatbelts or anything like that. And it was a deliberate strategy. It made the problem of road deaths, which were a new phenomenon at that time, it made it your fault. And the solution is your action. You individually stop causing the problem that you individually are causing. That's what it's all about. And that was a strategy of distraction from the actions that could bring about system change, like having speed limits, better road safety procedures, driving licenses, tests, all the rest of it, safety standards for vehicles. And that is the same thing that's happening. That's why BP has promoted the idea of a carbon footprint. And I think the crucial thing to recognize is that there is not some sort of different universe between individual action and system change. How does system change happen in the economy? How does it happen in society? It happens because individual people do stuff. It cannot happen without that. And my favorite climate change film, if you want to see a good film about climate change, watch a Korean film called 1987, When the Day Comes. It's actually not about climate change at all. It's about a democracy movement. The beautiful thing about the film is there's no single main character. It goes through six main characters in sequence. Each one does the thing that only they can do through their particular role in society. Like a prison guard bears witness to the forced confession through torture that he's seen happening in prison. And that enables a journalist to go off and do something else. And a student does something else. And a priest does something else. Each one does something that only they can do in their position. But somebody else did something that enabled them to do it. And I think when, Gao, you talk about collaboration, that's the kind of collaboration that we need. There are activists in every single organization. There are activists in oil firms. I've met them. There are definitely activists in government. There are activists in the civil service. There are activists in NGOs. There are activists in businesses. There are people who just realize that they want to do the best they can from their position. That's what we need. That's not about your footprint. It's about your point of leverage. That's what everybody can do. And it's collaboration across those divides of different kinds of organizations that is really, really powerful. Thank you.
Just picking up on that point about finding your point of leverage, I'm just wondering whether you could say a little bit yourselves about your own journeys in terms of how you found your own points of leverage and what you're trying to do in terms of those points of leverage, and whether there's actually in that some wisdom for others. That I think we've talked about that the top down, bottom up, and the individual agency and the structural change, and the need to try and find those points of leverage for those who maybe feel that they haven't found those. Is there any wisdom you can share in terms of that? Can start anywhere.
I just really want to say, actually, first of all, that I think cultural change is absolutely essential, and we need our artists and our singers and our storytellers, our comedians, you know, because the anti-life system as it plays out in us stops us from having a vision of change being possible, and that's the role of the artist to help to show that and shape that. So I'm sorry for saying something, but I feel like, you know, in a way you're being played down a bit here. If you say, no, it's just about the waste industry. I feel like that ability to make us laugh and see who we are and so on is just super important. So thank you for doing that work, and Hard Art and all the other artists and singers and visionaries. Maybe I'll just retell the story of how Extinction Rebellion came about from my point of view. I have been curious about change for many years, and, you know, I was blessed to be friends with Polly Higgins and learn about ecocide law. I was obsessed with economics for about 3 years, and I met Steve Keen, actually. Told him I'd had him in the bath. Used to watch Steve Keen, you know, Steve Keen, who took on Nordhaus and that. I said, I had you in the bath, Steve. I don't think he was very amused by that, but... So, you know, learning about economics, etc. But after a while, you realise that the issue is there's loads and loads of good ideas. There's loads of policies that are on the shelf already that the clever people have come up with. The point is, how do things change, you know? And civil disobedience, civil resistance is a crucial part of making the change. It's not the only thing that needs to happen. And I was very, very sure that, as sure as a person can be, because there's always questions, that we needed mass civil disobedience, and that I wanted to start that. I read a George Monbiot book, and he was talking about tax injustice. And I was like, of course they've been, you know, working these tax havens for years. Why are we paying our taxes when there's tax dodging going off on industrial scales, etc.? So for about 6 years... I was trying to start mass civil disobedience, and I'd go around and I'd come to conferences about finance, mass civil disobedience, folks, and you go to Quaker conferences, etc. And it just felt quite difficult to find the second person, the right person to work with. And if I'm honest, I prayed. You know, I got to a point of saying, I mean this, universe. I really, really, really mean this. And I've been working with plant medicines for some years. And there's some scary plant medicines. You may have heard of ayahuasca, possibly less so, iboga. I went to a place to take plant medicines and pray. And my prayer was for the codes for social change and to find the team and to heal the parts of myself that were in the way. And it was the most terrifying thing that I've ever done, because some of those plant medicines take you to... They're like throwing your own consciousness off a cliff. A month after taking those plant medicines, I came back to the UK, met Roger Hallam, and he told me that we had a four-hour meeting in which, at the end of it, he said, I've just given you the codes for social change, and the actual words of the prayer. And I've had that experience more than once, that... when you're offering your service and your gifts to life and you ask for help beyond what the day-to-day says, the help will come. And so what a strange leverage point to mention, but I think something else is here with us. I think I can say that in a Christian festival. And that we are going to go through an ordeal. We are going into an ordeal, and it's a time for human consciousness to move. And maybe I sound like a hippie saying that, but that's what I believe. This is fundamentally a crisis of separation. and it's time for a reunion with life. And there will be many ways for us to show up in that. And in that way, the leverage really is your own gifts and being open to life and what it wants to say through you. So that's what I want to say. Thank you.
I really like that way of thinking about it as well. As you mentioned that in your speech earlier today about you think about what your gifts are, and I think that is really specific. Where are your sphere of influences and where you fit in that, and trying to think about where you can be proactive. And I also want to be clear that when I did say that, you know, a lot of these things like recycling or the things we do around the house because we care, I don't mean to belittle them or to say that they are worthless. Because some people might say, oh, they're just gestural. But gestures can be incredibly powerful. And even in a small sense, they can be very powerful. Like I said, that's the way we change, is what people around us are doing. And if people are seeing you doing these small actions, it is a way of signposting that you care about this topic, and then that will spread in whatever way. So it's not meaningless at all. But I think that is the key thing. What can I do? What's personal? What's special about me? And what can I bring to the table? And in stand-up comedy, I didn't discuss anything of any value. It was all smutty and disgraceful. But... and it largely silly, as I'm being honest with you. But through that job, it got me thinking, well, maybe I should talk about this a bit. And it is hard, because it is a bummer of a topic, and it's in a lot of ways not a laughing matter. But there is ways around that, and it might be difficult, but you know, that's how we can get, again, that discussion going. And I love it when I hear people who have got, well, I was just talking to Simon today about what his background is, and he said he was a civil servant. And actually, didn't you protest his building once? Yeah. She said, you might remember me. What did you do? You stuck...
Well, it was just me. I sort of climbed up and put frack off on Bays, because we had the anti-frackers with us, and we had a number of other... Actually, I'll tell you what I did also. I put glued on a sign and stuck my hand on the... But I didn't actually glue on, because I was a bit worried about needing a wee.
You were miming.
Yeah, I was miming. But... come on, who is that amazing woman who used to do a lot? She's doing Palace. Yeah. Do anybody remember Jenny Shearer? She was just fucking gluing herself left, right and centre to everything that... She glued on with two hands, you know, so she couldn't even scratch. That's a proper activist, not like me. It's like, oh, I'm a bit glued on, not really. Just I actually went off for a piss and came back and nobody seemed to notice, got a sandwich. I tell you what, that is the thing with... I did do a lock-on once. And when you... Do you know what I mean? You get your arm in these tubes and you sort of attach. And you can do this thing where you give these speeches and you explain about civil disobedience and you say, you know, it's really important and this is how the change comes. You get people fired up. Talk about a lock-on or gluing on. And then everybody just goes, what about the toilet? What about the toilet? And you're like... You wear a nappy. And they're like... I fucking care about the planet, but I'm not pissing in a nappy in public. You know what I mean? And I tell you what, if you do, sorry, I'm just having a laugh now. I'm doing his job. If you do a lock on, up north, I'm getting a bit northern for you. They just feed you loads of cups of tea in jam jars, and then you're desperate for a piss, and you're like. And what I learned afterwards about the nappy thing is you've got to wee in small amounts. Not all in one go. So put me in the back of this police van, and I was like, I can't see my face. You know, when you finally, I'm just going to pee in this nappy because I'm not going to get to the cells for ages. Like that. And it just went everywhere. And a more experienced activist said, Gail, you've got to let it out in bits. And I thought, it's really good for your pelvic floor, sisters. So, activism, pelvic floor, it's all good, it's all benefits. So, I forgot what the question... Oh, Bays, that was it, Bays. Yeah. No, we put frack off, that was it. And then, yeah, and then people glued themselves to the building. And you know, you hear, the civil servants behind the scenes are going... Carry on, crack on. Greta Thunberg said it. I've had civil servants whispering in my ear. And then you get in court and you try to say to the judge, do you know that civil servants want us to do this? And they're like, that's not relevant. That's not relevant. Oh, this is what they say. I had to have my prison bag with me in court because apparently it's not relevant. Mark Carney had said thank you to me in public. I said, it was literally on the BBC. He said, you started a social movement, thank you. That's not relevant. Shush, 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 shush. Because it's not just that the court system can't cope with climate change. It can't cope with civil resistance theory. Not allowed to talk about it. So maybe just to wind it back to an actual point rather than just showing off, which I'm doing. Anyway, but I've forgotten what my point is now. that'll show me, won't it?
My point was going to be...
Go on.
It has an influence. Those things have an influence because he saw you and was like, I remember that. And I remember thinking, yeah, you're right. And like, you went from that into all this work you've been doing. So... yeah, these little things might seem small at the time, and is this actually having an effect? Yes, it clearly, you're sowing all these seeds, and you never know which one is going to sprout, and which when you'll end up with a panel on them in 10 years' time. But yes, what was you, I think you should go back to you.
Sure, just briefly, because you're asking sort of how do you figure out what it is you can do. Well, first, just to follow that, because I do remember this episode, and it does make a difference. You know, a lot of the time, government ministers... they don't really know what people think. They get a few opinion polls, but they also read the newspapers and they see the Daily Mail every day telling them that people don't care about climate change and they really just care about all these EU regulations, or, you know, the Telegraph whinging about electric vehicles for the 15,000th day in a row. And they don't really know what to think. And when you get loads of people out in Parliament Square or blocking the bridges over the Thames or all over the place, it does make a difference. And actually, around that time, it was not only Extinction Rebellion, but it was the school children coming out as well, inspired by Greta Thunberg. And I remember this day when all the school kids were out in front of Parliament, and myself and lots of my colleagues just went out to just soak up the atmosphere and be glad about the fact that this was happening. And I remember seeing this little girl who looked about 7 years old carrying a sign that said, "We'll stop protesting when you stop being so shit." That was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I tried to say to her, "Great sign," and I think she just thought, "Weird old man." But it was brilliant. You feel empowered, and I could feel tangibly a difference in the dynamic, that ministers were worried. They were shaken up. They were really shaken, and they felt they had to show that they were doing something. And that whole dynamic was part of what ended up with the UK hosting the UN climate change talks in 2021. And despite having a government that wasn't full of people who are natural political leaders, actually making a reasonably decent fist of it, I would say, better than most countries do when they host these things. So, I mean, for me, in a way, for people here, it doesn't really matter. How did I figure out my particular niche? I figured out that the thing that I enjoyed doing was taking areas of academic understanding and pulling them into government, where instead of leaving them for another 10 years before they gradually filter in, just pull them in more quickly and go, hey, this looks like something that we need to know, and this could change some decisions we make. And that's what I found out was my niche. I think the important general point is, in a problem this big, everything is a niche, and you shouldn't feel bad about that. You shouldn't feel guilty because you haven't come up with a thing that can solve the entire problem. You never will. Nobody will. Every single thing is just a niche. And I remember that the best career advice I ever had was when I was asking somebody much older about working in different kinds of organizations and which of these had more influence. Was it government? Was it the private sector? Was it NGOs or something, or political parties? And he said, look, it doesn't matter. There's influence from every point in the system. What matters is, which point in the system will you be happy to occupy, and will you do a good job when you occupy? That's what really matters. So I think that's how you find your point of leverage.
Brilliant. I just love that last phrase. Which point in the system are you happy to occupy? I think that's a great phrase. We're going to move to questions in a second. So if you've got a question, then get your thinking brains on.
What about philanthropy then?
What's that? Yeah. Oh, I didn't swerve that one. We could come back to that one. We had a good discussion earlier about the role of philanthropy. So we can maybe come back to that, Gail. In fact, you can do it on this round if you want. We need, I'm going to, a quick plug as a preamble. Any of you listen to a podcast called Outrage and Optimism at all? I highly, highly, few of you, highly, highly recommend it if you want to kind of keep track on exactly this topic in terms of levers for change and how we're doing and tracking progress. And they always finish each interview with a question, just one thing from the panel that you're outraged by at the moment in terms of this space, and one thing that you're optimistic about. So really, really brief, quick fire round. One thing you're outraged by, one thing that you're optimistic about, or one or the other if you can't do both, and then we'll go to questions.
In terms of an outrage, I'm personally quite outraged at the disparity between the prison sentences being given to the rioters versus the prison sentences given to the five climate change activists who didn't even protest. They would just happen to be on a Zoom call with a Sun journalist who I'd love to get my hands on. No, metaphorically. But you know what I mean. And actually that meeting was about how do we protest in a responsible way. I think the discussions were going on with stuff about how, you know, cater for emergency vehicles. Something that didn't happen to the man who visited five pubs on his way to assault a police officer. And he was given a year and a half, I think, against five. So that's the thing I'm particularly outraged about. I haven't got any optimism. I'm a miserable bastard. Sorry. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, just hearing these two, I had a wonderful chat. And Simon told me some wonderful, you know, like he said, his niche, finding these incredible ideas. So hearing those, I get to meet a lot of clever people and they always make me feel better. So, yes.
This way.
One of the things that made me feel optimistic recently was listening to the wonderful Roma talking about the first youth assembly in Stroud and the growing assembly movements that are happening across the UK right now. And in that way, I see them as a counter to the thing that outrages me, which is the growing fascism. And I do think we have to be very careful when we're talking about these sentences, even just to be really honest about it, because this is people living within a system that are going to pull some of it. We're all humanity. And whatever some people are doing, they are reflections and mirrors of what's in ourselves. You know, there is a fascist in me. I know her a bit well, too well at times, right? And what is it that's driving people towards hatred? And where do I hate? You know, so where can we find togetherness, and how can we make decisions together and be in spaces? So it's sort of like systemically finding solutions to fascism, like ways in which we think about it together, but with individuals in our communities, there's trauma there, and how do we meet it with love? You know, I've got a very amazing, wonderful sister called Skeena Rathore, who we have this, okay, maybe controversial thing to say, but I think it's an awful fascist newspaper called The Light being handed out in Stroud that's pushing some conspiracy, I don't mean everything in it's wrong, pushing some conspiracy theories. And we've got that kind of anti-fascist movement in Stroud that quite understandably is angry and polarised. And so there's a polarisation happening in my hometown. And my dear sister behind the scenes is meeting people with love and talking to them, listening and asking them to stop handing it out. And she's being successful, you know, and I think there's much that we can do that puts us on stage and massages our egos and gets us sort of seen and whatever, but it's the quiet things behind the scenes that come from a place of love and compassion and connection and faith in humanity. That's what makes me feel optimistic, as if I actually believe in us as a species. Yeah, thank you.
Gary, you're really hard to follow. Do you know that?
Talk about economics, because I love that.
Go on.
Because he was telling me stuff. We were having a cup of tea. Yeah, no, I will. I will have you in the bath, if you don't mind.
Oh, anytime. Outrage already.
Outraged.
No, okay, I've got an outrage one. And I think both of you already alluded to the role of the media. And I'm particularly outraged by the Daily Mail and the Telegraph, because they're waging a campaign against action on climate change. They're waging this determinedly. And the bizarre thing is, they don't really have a good reason to do it. They don't have strong vested interests. They're not owned by oil millionaires. You might think that they are from the way that they give a platform to denialists and publish misinformation every day. But it's even cruder than that. It's just that they think it's what their readers will be entertained by. And it's what they think that they want to hear. And it's absolutely inexcusable. I think it's disgusting. And the one of the reasons it's so dangerous is that who fights the media? Who's going to take them on? You know, the government can't fight the media for some very good democratic reasons, but also because politicians are scared of it for reasons we can all understand. Activist movements, it's very difficult for them to target the media as well, because then the media can all paint them as extremists and make it harder for them to win over the public. NGOs don't fight the media. Who does? It's extremely difficult. It's very dangerous. I think it's absolutely reckless and inexcusable. And I hope that there are some elements of activism that can take them on directly. I also think one of the points of leverage to get them is the advertising industry. That advertisers should pull all of their advertising from the Daily Mail and the Telegraph until they promise to sack their editors and never ever publish disinformation on climate change ever again. Of course, they can have a different point of view, but it's one thing to have a point of view and it's something else to run a campaign the way they're doing, which is inexcusable. So thank you for giving me the chance to get that off my chest. For optimism, there are many reasons to be optimistic, and I feel like just giving a small one, which is Indian bus procurement. The government's done such a great job, bulk procurement of electric buses. They did a pilot with 5,000 buses, and it went so brilliantly well that 6 months later they did, right, we're going to do it again with 50,000 buses. And they're getting buses into Indian cities that didn't have buses before. They're having cleaner air. They're electric vehicles. They're not emitting carbon. And other countries are looking at that going, oh, that's pretty good. We should do some of that too.
I wasn't expecting the answer Indian bus procurement on the reason for optimism. So we can all go away feeling very optimistic about that, which is great. So let's move then to... now, we had a bit of a disagreement on this. I like a question with a question mark at the end. Gail is very happy for a comment, and then we said a short comment. So short comments or questions with a question mark at the end, and you can direct it to an individual or to everyone. And Helen is going to do the roving mic.
Hi, thank you. I'm also a co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. I've been tracking some of the things over the years, and since the Rio Summit in the 90s, Copenhagen 2009, Extinction Rebellion, carbon emissions have continued to go up, and the rate of increase of carbon emissions has continued to go up globally. And so my understanding is, like, everything that we've done to slow carbon emissions seems to have failed because it's not only increased, it's increased the rate of increase. And so we've just come from an optimism, and I'm bringing something else that says, like, is it not just human-centric bullshit to assume that we have any kind of leverage over these systems at all that seem to just ignore us and go faster and faster and faster? And, like... is there some, I guess, where is the leverage? Because I don't think it's human.
Yeah, thanks. It's a great question to ask. Look, I would honestly say it's not that bad in a way. Like, the problem is horrendous, and it's close to being out of our control. But it's not, I wouldn't say it's the case that everything that we've done has failed. Emissions are a lagging indicator of change. They'll be the last thing to change. The fundamental process that we're talking about is a technology transition. And I don't mean that in a sort of technocentric, it's only about technology and nothing else. Technology transitions are all about society. They're all about actors. Who does what and why do they do it? But fundamentally, in the bits of the economy that the greenhouse gas emissions come from, we have to change a thing that burns fossils into something else that doesn't. That's the core thing. And technology transitions follow a pattern. They follow an S-curve, where the new thing, it grows over time in ways that look very, very slow at first, and then suddenly very, very fast, and then eventually they level off and go slowly. That's the pattern they pretty much always follow. And if you look at the parts of the economy where we have been doing the right kind of things, you see that pattern playing out. The power sector is the one where we're the furthest ahead. Solar and wind look like very, very slow for ages, but they're now on the part where they grow really, really fast. They're cutting into the coal and gas. And the latest expectations are that this year will be the first year when power sector emissions globally start going down instead of up. And after that, the change is going to be really fast and you'll see the coal starting to fall out. So I think, of course, it's much, much slower than we wanted it to be. It's slower than we needed it to be. But actually, we do have a lot of agency. We do have leverage. Stuff we've been doing has been working. And it's just that we're early in the transition and the emissions will follow. That will come later.
I'm so glad to hear that. And I also think we've got to remember that it's not a climate crisis, it's a biodiversity loss crisis, it's a pollution crisis, and that's just the environmental side of it, right? I mean, there's many other aspects of the meta crisis or the poly crisis that we're in. I think we're in a fundamentally, in the global north at least, and across the world in many places, but in a fundamental problematic way in which we relate to life, in which we're in our lives, in which we've been enculturated, in which we've been educated. There's a vast miseducation system. The enculturation system, which includes the media, is vastly problematic. And now we want to bring in AI, which can speed up some highly problematic aspects of. I mean, you could get very miserable about this. So I'm more with you, Stu, really. And I think for me, then, the levers of change are like, how do we disempower this system that's running, that's out of control and is eating life? And that's why, like, it is a big question, where are the levers? And that's why philanthropy needs to be the pioneer species for the new lives that we want to live. And then it's about how we create what's needed, the post-capitalist infrastructure as things fall to pieces. And that, to me, means, like, I'm really glad for all the transitions that are happening, and yay, the electric buses in India that I didn't know about. So it's good, but I wouldn't want to be in, for myself at least, being myself, a pretense that, like, we're just about to get this right, folks. I think we're just about to, the shit is hitting the fan. And how are we going to be in that time together?
Yeah, so I'm really glad to come after that question because I want to talk about civil resistance as well. So if civil resistance is one of the levers, at the moment in the UK, it seems to go in waves. We had Extinction Rebellion, we had Insulate Britain, we had Animal Rising, we had Just Stop Oil. I know some of them have come concurrently. Is that how it has to be? Does it need to build up? Or is that not the way going forward? I guess I'm looking at Gail, but I'm also interested to see... Yeah.
Let me make sure I've got your question right. Sorry, that whether it comes in waves. I mean, honestly, and the waves that you've just talked about had a lot to do with my dear brother and colleague, and he's also a pain in the neck, Roger Hallam, right? Just to be frank. And he's been jailed now for 5 years. The Free the Whole Truth 5 is the petition to look up online. There's another researcher, and I'm afraid I've forgotten his name, but he talks about an emoticycle, you know, that we sort of keep building people up to think this is how the change is going to come through. Just one more big push. And I don't believe that that's how the change will come. I think resistance is an aspect, and it helps to reveal the system's inability to change. And when we market to people, you know, our Roger's a brilliant marketeer, actually, but to say, join this because it's going to make the change happen, that can actually be quite a sort of toxic form of eldering in a way, because you're sort of raising people's expectations that the change is going to come through this thing. What it's doing is helping reveal the system. But I do personally feel like it's time to... I feel like we're in a change process as movements, but I may be just in my own experience. As I say, I think it's more of a spiritual crisis than anything. So how do we bring all of those aspects together for ourselves and in our communities? I see it much more at a community level now, that's where the change needs to be focused. And then you can bring resistance in at a community level. I mean, for example... talking about why are we paying our water bills, mortgages, similar rents. Can we not get enough togetherness in our communities to say no to capitalist extraction within our communities? Like, I think that would be like, you have the concept of the People's Republic of Stroud. It's sort of a bit of a joke and a t-shirt, but I think self-rule, you know, creating alternative structures in communities, building the assemblies, etc. I think that's really super important at this stage, and that's what's going to catch us as we fall to pieces. So it will have resistance as part of it, but I've sort of felt like, with the resistance struggles, which we're sort of dragging people into London on a regular basis. And again, I don't want to make anything bad and wrong, but it's kind of the community side of it is plays second fiddle. The building of regenerative cultures absolutely gets played third fiddle. And that's what we need to take us forward. So I'm not sure about sucking us into London for actions. Again, please, if that's what you're doing, I don't know for sure. I would more say one needs to calculate and be really clear whether we do have enough power to make a move. You know, Naomi Klein would say, well, what's your demands? Well, your demands are as big as your movement. So how much are you building your movement? And Rogers Designs are trying to get a movement to build off the back of each other. If it's not working, then you have to regroup. You know, I think maybe the last thing to say is just listening to, there's a very cool thing online called Internarratives, if you're interested in narrative change. Paddy Loughman and others run it. And the last one was on fascism, actually. But there was a subsection on strategy making. Sorry, I'm a bit of a nerd for strategy. And so, but one of the things they do in Abya-Yala in Latin America is whenever they're in a space together, they do something called conjunctural analysis. And I think it's probably emergent strategy, actually, Stu, in a way. Like, what is the conjuncture that we're in right now, and what should our strategy making change? How should it react to the specific moment that we're in right now? So we have all these different groups operating. Are we really talking to each other? I find that quite painful that there's not more of that going off. And then when do we get together and go, okay, this is the moment, this is how we respond? Because for sure that's what's happening on the right. They're well organized, you know. I have to say, I don't quite agree with you on the media front, by the way. I think there's a reason why they're the media are fighting us, partly because, is that all right to go off on one about something else? Yeah, there's loads of stuff in it. Yap, sorry. It was Helen Knowlton that started the PR campaign on tobacco, and they play the same playbook, right? Climate denial, tobacco denial. And now they're doing discourses of delay, and that's been pumped out through the media, 12 different ways to stop climate action. Like, why would that be happening? Because basically, if you're going to do actual action that's actually going to make a difference, I don't think you can do it without some version of something like socialism. And that's why they're stopping it, foundationally. I think they've understood a long time ago that the change is going to be some eco-social... it's labels, right? But I think that's what it's about. A shout-out for Donica McCarthy, who works a lot on the media, by the way. Thank you.
Another... one more question, maybe? Anyone?
Thank you. Quick comment. Thank you, Extinction Rebellion. I was starting to lose the will to live. I used to be a protester and seeing so much inactivity for so many years. So there's my comment. The question is, do you feel with the punishments that have been handed down to demonstrators that this is going to have an impact on what goes on protest-wise from now on, from your perspective?
Well, why don't we do an audience survey? Is anybody thinking about doing non-violent civil disobedience, civil resistance, direct action? Thank you. Leave your hands up. Do the sentences put you off? Put your hands down if so. So it's Sue Parfitt there. You can't, she's terrible. I'm kidding, sorry, sister. It looks like it does have a bit of an impact. Yeah, I mean, I think it does depend which judge you get. The one I had in Isleworth didn't look like the kind of guy who wants to imprison us. And I happen to have a friendship with somebody who's quite high up in the legal system, let's say. And they are very different judges, and some of them will be more lenient than others. It's a matter of luck. But that's what they're designed to do, is put us off, aren't they? So, you know, changes happen in the past because people go, you know, two fingers to the system, and you just have to keep doing that if you have the privilege to be able to do that. Carry on resisting. Thank you.
But can we all say a big green belt? Thank you to our panel.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.